name of that group?
Okay, I want to do what academics do, and that is to step back a little bit and try to talk about context and a bit of history so we can understand who these people are and what the project is and what they're about. And when you look at what's happened to the contemporary right over the past 25 years, there's something curious about it that doesn't really, on the face of it, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. This is a political project and a political campaign that's been in power for the better part of a quarter of a century. And that's a long time. That's a whole generation. It's gone through a whole series of changes and developments. And one of the things that's happened over the past 25 years, which is really contrary to a lot of historical experience and contrary to a lot of social science theory, is that this right-wing movement has gotten steadily more and more radical over time. Not less so. Social scientists expect that as movements develop, they have a tendency to become less radical over time. They tend to get founded by ideologues. They tend to get organized by crusaders. They're very excited in the beginning. They have grand projects and big schemes. And over time, so goes a lot of social movement theory, they become co-opted. They get some accomplishments under their belts. They make deals with politicians. They develop a certain stake in the existing order. And generally speaking, the radical hard edges of the movements tend to drop off and they tend to be accommodated. And that hasn't happened here. What's happened with the right over the past 25 years is its opposite. It's gotten more radical and not less. It's gotten more ideological and not less. It's gotten more excited and not less. And it's happened from the grassroots to the top of the movement. There's a tendency when we look at the kinds of things Michael's talking about to focus exclusively on the president and his chief officers. But what we're witnessing with regard to the right in general is that from the grassroots all the way through, you're seeing a much more organized, a much more excited, a much more militant, and a much more aggressive right wing. And what I mean by that is that we have to look not only at the Bush administration, which is arguably the most radically right-wing administration, certainly in the country's recent history, but you have to look also at the Congress, the congressional Republicans, beginning certainly from 1994 on, and that's 13 years now. When you look at people like Senator Thune from South Dakota and some of these guys from the Southwest, you're dealing with a radically right-wing Republican Party from which, as we all know from the last elections, whatever remnants of East Coast Republican moderation have been long expelled, and at the grassroots as well. This is a very, very, very radical movement. So one of the questions is why? You know, what's been going on to produce this tendency, and how does it eventuate in the so-called theory of the unitary president and the attack on civil liberties? I'm going to try to spend just a few minutes with you trying to set some of the problems in their context. In some senses, this whole intensification of this movement's radical project really took a leap forward after 9/11. And we all know that that's what happens in times of terrorism, and it's what happens in times of crisis and war, is that already existing tendencies tend to get exaggerated and tend to get intensified. And that's certainly what's been happening here. So there are two ways to look at this thing. On the one hand, you can look at what happened after 9/11. And it does seem as though a lot of the people around the president, a lot of the people in Congress, and a lot of people at the grassroots were genuinely freaked out and genuinely super worried about what had developed after 9/11 and sought ways in which to cope with a new environment of threat and of danger. On the other hand, these tendencies always had been there in the radical right. And they were intensified and used by people for whom 9/11 was a present and for whom Osama bin Laden turns out to be their great ally. So when you look at the various pieces of the contemporary right, there are authoritarian tendencies in almost all of them. And the contemporary right is a coalition, like most political movements, and it's a coalition of elements who, in some senses, disagree with each other and are in conflict with each other and historically have been at war with each other, and on the other hand, come together around certain shared projects. There are lots of elements of this coalition. There are signs now that it's beginning to fray a little bit, but for our purposes, for the purposes of trying to figure out the war on civil liberties, there are a couple of elements of these coalitions that are particularly important. One of them are the moral authoritarians, originating in the South, people who have long been calling for a strong Christian state to regulate people's private behavior, legislate morality, and get the country back to God. And when you go back to Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson and all these guys coming out of the South, these people were able to blend religious revivalism and excitement on the one hand with old-fashioned political authoritarianism on the other. So that's one piece of it. These people are mostly worried about domestic affairs, and they mostly arose as a reaction to the break, what they perceived as the catastrophic breakdown of authority during the 60s, and particularly as it manifested itself in the women's movement and in racial matters. So as they called for a restoration of male authority, and as they called for a restoration of racial peace, they were not afraid to call upon the state as their chief ally in this. And when you read people like Falwell, and as unpleasant as it is, it makes sense to do it, they're calling for a Christian state, and they're calling for a Christian government. So that's one piece of it. Another piece of it, for our purposes, tends to focus on foreign policy, and these are the neoconservatives. And in some respects, the neocons and the Christian warriors of the South share certain presumptions, but they also disagree about lots. Many of the neocons are Eastern, cosmopolitan, Jewish intellectuals. Many of them, as they themselves point out, were defenders of the New Deal. They see themselves as social reformers. They were friendly to FDR. They didn't much like Lyndon Johnson and the war on poverty. But in foreign affairs, these are authoritarian statists. Their major concern was with the restoration of American authority in international sphere and, of course, with the restoration of presidential authority when it comes to conducting foreign policy. We'll come back to that in a second. When it comes to certain issues, the Southern-based moral authoritarians, on the one hand, and the neocons in matters of foreign policy, on the other, don't agree about a whole lot. The neocons have no use for the moralizing, Christianizing project of the American South. And the people in the South are suspicious of the neocons' secularism and their tendency at times to support social reform. So there are, even as there are wide areas of agreement around presidential authority and the restoration of the state, there are serious disagreements. And you can see now, as this movement begins to fray apart, you begin to see some of the consequences of these disagreements. It makes sense to start in trying to figure out what is the connection between this this excitable, politicized, contradictory coalition that comprises the contemporary right and the assault on civil liberties. It begins to make sense to start at the center with Dick Cheney. And Cheney is only, there's a tendency to paint Cheney as the Darth Vader of this whole thing, and John Stewart always paints Cheney as a guy who walks into a room and sucks all the air out of the room. And while all that's true, and Stewart is really wonderful on Cheney. But it's not just Cheney. Cheney, this thing really does start with Bush. Cheney is the guy who's articulated it and whose record for the last 30 years in and out of Washington has been most clear. Cheney, ever since the Ford administration, Cheney has had two projects. And his projects mirror what I've been saying and also kind of sum up the attitude of the contemporary right to the state. Cheney's analysis is that the great debilitating set of constraints that emerged out of the 60s, out of the war in Vietnam, needed to be overturned in the interests of American security on the one hand and American prosperity at home on the other. Those two constraints historically have been called the so-called Watergate syndrome, and the second was the so-called Vietnam syndrome. And Cheney's mind, Cheney has a very articulated, I mean, Cheney is a reflexive authoritarian, but he does have a position. And the position is that coming out of the Watergate scandals, you saw a crippling of the power of the presidency, a weakening of the tendency of power in the United States to flow toward Washington, and that it was important for a vigorous, muscular presidency to be able to overcome the legacy of the restrictions on presidential power that came out of Watergate. The second, and from Cheney's point of view, the most important restrictions revolve around what the historians and what the people in these movements call the so-called Vietnam Syndrome, which were a series of restrictions, both institutional and legal, that were put on the president's power to conduct foreign policy that came out of the war in Vietnam. On both of these issues, Cheney has long been agitating in and around government that the legacy of both the Vietnam Syndrome and the Watergate Syndrome had to be undone. And the reason that Cheney constructed this parallel office around his office of vice president was precisely to do this. And whether it's Scooter Libby or Douglas Feith, but the real bad guy in the whole story is David Addington, about whom people don't know a whole lot. Addington is a longtime associate of Dick Cheney's. He has replaced Scooter Libby as Cheney's chief of staff. Addington, for the last 30 years, has had one project and one project only as he's worked with Cheney. Every single initiative coming out of Congress, every single law that's been proposed by the president is vetted by Cheney's office and in particular by Addington. And the one question that's on the table always is, what is this going to do to the authority and the power of the president? Cheney is, of all the people around Bush, the one who is most closely associated with this power to revive the power of the executive. Now, how does that dovetail with a larger political project? After all presidents want to consolidate their power. And every president, for example, since the Vietnam War, has resisted the War Powers Act. It's not just Bush that resists it. Clinton resisted it as well. So presidents, almost regardless of their ideological position and their political party, do tend to want to preserve and extend their own power. But when it comes to these guys and the contemporary political project of this very ideological, very excited, and now very radical right, we have to associate these kinds of bureaucratic and legal positions with their larger political project. And that is that, and I think this is really what accounts for this odd radicalization of the contemporary right. The right arose out of the what they saw as the chaos and the decay and the decline of the 1960s, with two projects in mind. The central project was to utterly destroy American liberalism. Their target was never the left. The target of the right has always been the legacy of American liberalism coming out of the New Deal. With regard to the current administration, the most extreme form of this has been an attempted attack on the most significant piece of social legislation coming out of the New Deal, which was Social Security. The reason that the attack on Social Security and the attempt to privatize it was so important is that Social Security has always represented to the contemporary right everything about liberalism and social reform that they hated. And that is the statement that the Social Security law made and that the defense of Social Security was always organized around, which is that we live in a society in which people have mutual responsibilities to each other. And Social Security was predicated on the notion that one need not act in public affairs with only one's narrowly defined immediate self-interest in mind. When Margaret Thatcher famously said in 1978, and this is 2 years before Reagan, when Margaret Thatcher famously said, there is no such thing as society, she said. There was only individual men and women and their families. That was Margaret Thatcher's famous line in England. And that, if there is a talisman to the contemporary right, that's the talisman. So the kind of the three pillars of the contemporary right, privatization, deregulation, and elimination of all taxes and all burdens on wealth came together in the assault on Social Security. But the funny thing about the way in which Bush phrased it is that the ideology and the rhetoric of the attack on Social Security was anti-statist. And this is one of the contradictions that you find in the contemporary right. Here's Bush talking about the opportunity of society and talking, as the right always has, that the government and bureaucracies and social reform and social welfare stifle individual liberty, get in the way of individual opportunity. It's time to set the individual free so he or she can make his or her own decisions and let the magic of the marketplace decide about winners and losers. So the attack on social reform and the attack on a state-organized policy of economic redistribution took the form of a state-organized, anti-statist, set of positions. And this has been true since Ronald Reagan became president and announced that government was the problem, and that the way in which the government had to move was to get government out of people's pockets and off of their backs. So there are these kinds of inherent contradictions. The second piece of it has to do with the destruction or the attempt to destroy liberalism internationally and when it comes to foreign affairs. And this is really where the chickens do come home to roost. The whole structure of international law, the whole structure of treaty obligations, and particularly the liberal, and when I say liberal, I mean that this was also basically agreed to by Ford and by Nixon as well, and even by Reagan. The whole structure of the United Nations, the whole sense that the United States lives in a world society, just as individual citizens live in a domestic society, that too has been the target of the right. And so what you have is a celebration of unilateralism. You have this notion of preemption, which, as Michael said, and it's true, is a totally preposterous from the standpoint of international law. It's a totally preposterous position that a state has the right to act in advance of any real threat. But whether it's an attack on international law or the UN or allies or treaty obligations, there's a coming together of these two prongs of this attack on contemporary liberalism, namely an assault upon the idea that power can be constrained by obligation to others, whether domestically or internationally. What you have is a coherent ideology that says that power is what power does. There's this very, very famous interview that Ron Suskind reported on. I don't know if you guys saw this in the Times Magazine section about a year and a half ago. And he was talking with a highly placed administration official about the difference between a faith-based community and a reality-based community. And what this guy said, and it's funny on some levels, but it's not funny on others, is this was the classic statement of the authoritarian. We create our own reality. Power does what power does. And the important thing is to loosen the constraints upon power so that it can do what it needs to do. Now, when that is allied with the notion that you are living in the world's most favored country and that God intends the United States to reorganize the world, you have yourself the theory of the unitary presidency. And that has been articulated. There's a tendency when you look at George Bush to look at him as an inarticulate fool who can barely speak a coherent sentence, but there really is a coherent body of thought behind all this. The theory of the unitary presidency is a theory of untrammeled executive power. It is contemptuous not only of international treaty obligations, it is openly contemptuous of the Congress, it is openly contemptuous of any legal strictures on its authority, and it is a particularly ruthless and a particularly aggressive formulation of an intensification and concentration of all the trends that have marked the contemporary right. So we're back to the original question. The original question is how did these guys get to be so radical? How did this thing develop? Well, there are three or four possibilities to explain just why this tendency to concentrate power and to have done with the notion that we live in a society with obligations to others. There are a bunch of different possibilities about why this happened. The first is that people who observe radical social movements observe that they often become radicalized to the extent that they're isolated. The more isolated they are, the more radical they tend to become. That's probably not the case here, since these guys have been in power and have had a remarkable series of successes for the better part of 25 years now. Another possibility is that as the time horizon seems to shrink, but as the goals become more ambitious, the tendency is to say, I have so little time to do this very important project, so let's ratchet things up and get more concentrated and get more serious about it. The third, which is also a real possibility, is this is simply a matter of historic opportunity, that 9/11 opened the door to these guys. There's a very, very famous conversation that McGeorge Bundy reports on in his memoirs in discussion about the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. When they're sitting around talking about how they're going to respond to what they thought at the time was a real North Vietnamese attack on these two American destroyers. And in retrospect, Bundy says that when they were talking about how to respond, Walt Rostow, who was this political scientist, one of the lessons of all this is whether you look at Walt Rostow or Wolfowitz or any of these guys, is don't let political scientists, or Henry Kissinger, don't let political scientists get anywhere near state power. Keep us here. Keep us away from any influence at all, because the marriage of ideology and the marriage of power is really, really dangerous. Rostow was talking about how trains leave the station on a predetermined schedule, but every so often there's a rogue element that sneaks in, and you got to know when to jump on. And Rostow reports that the Gulf of Tonkin resolution and the Gulf of Tonkin incident was just such a historic opportunity. It was time to get on board. It's very likely that these guys saw 9/11 as a historic opportunity to do that which they had always been wanting to do, to do that which they had intended to do, and that which they had been organizing to do. And so we're in this kind of new world of preemptive strikes, both at home and domestically.